And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. And again, we do hope you will be generous during our pledge drive and support some of the local and regional programs that you hear each and every day on WLRN. Well, the subject of today's program, Hall of Fame pitcher Lefty Gomez. He was 6-0 in World Series starts and a perennial All-Star during his career. He was the starter for the American League in the first All-Star game and, ironically, drove in its first run. He was known for his wit, style, good nature, generosity, and blazing fastball. Joining me now is the daughter of Lefty Gomez, Vernona Gomez, and author Lawrence Goldstone. They've collaborated on the book Lefty, An American Odyssey. Vernona joins us from Fairfield, Connecticut, and Lawrence Goldstone from the Hamptons. Welcome to you both. We're going to have fun during this hour, I think.
Good afternoon.
Well, thank you.
As a boomer baseball fan, I'd always thought Gomez was of Mexican descent. I figured he was kind of dark and maybe had a mustache or something, but of course that's totally wrong. Vernona?
Well, he probably favors his mother's side. She was Irish and Welsh. And that's what also, besides being blonde and tall and gangly, you know, as he said, my battle to get up to the major leagues was the point that I was so thin I didn't even cast a shadow. I was built like 6 o'clock. He was 6'2" and weighed 125 pounds. And, you know, only the Yankees would take a chance on him, like in later years when Joe DiMaggio, you know, injured himself getting out of the taxicab. Bill Essex, the Yankee scout, would take a chance on Joe, which, of course, for baseball was phenomenal because Joe turned out to be one of the greatest players that ever lived. But Dad was definitely fair, and but it was his dad who was, his grandfather came from Spain, and that's where the name Gomez comes from.
Larry Goldstone, tell me how this book came about, some odd circumstances, and it took a long time. Bennett Cerf was involved, and James Michener was involved.
Well, Lefty knew everybody. I mean, one of the things that drew me to the material was that it was hard to believe that an athlete, even by today's standards, was intimate with so many people in so many different walks of life, people like Jack Dempsey and Bennett Cerf and James Michener. And evidently, I wasn't around for that part of it, James Michener wanted to do Lefty's biography, and Lefty didn't really have the time and sit down, and at some point, Lefty and Vernona, I believe, went to her dad and said, you know, I'm not James Michener, but let's do it. And then Vernona came to me. I first knew Vernona because she was my daughter's piano teacher, and we used to go shopping for secondhand clothes and do all sorts of cool things, and it was years after my daughter had stopped taking piano lessons, and Vernona came in one day, and she gave me an idea of some of the material she had, and Lefty's voice, he reminds me very much of the sportscaster Ring Lardner, and the material was so extraordinary, we got together, collaborated, and the book is the result.
You know, the picture on the book cover of Lefty, it's a full-face shot. He almost looks a little bit like a young George McGovern to me. Is that off base?
I worked for George McGovern.
Just a little bit.
Having worked for George McGovern, I don't believe that Lefty in any way except in that picture resembles him.
We're speaking with Vernona Gomez and Lawrence Goldstone about the book Lefty, An American Odyssey. Vernona, tell me more about Lefty or Vernon's youth. Very rural and kind of hard scrabble. He described himself as a bumpkin, but he certainly quickly adjusted to the big time in New York and the big leagues.
Well, you know, as he said, we weren't poor. We just didn't have any money. And as Larry and I said in the book, he grew up in the shadow of the homesteader, that in other words they had cows and chickens and vegetable gardens and all, but there wasn't any spare money. He had a very exciting upbringing because certainly the people who came before he graced his foot on the path of America, it's like part of the American fabric. His grandfather, you know, Gomez, was coming around during the Civil War and had his shot and had his boat shot out from under him by the Confederate raiders, and that's why he landed in San Francisco. And then his father, Coyote, who was born in America at 15, went and trailed cattle like, you know, we read about the cowboys, and his name was Coyote because he was a slick predator with a rope, and he trailed cattle for 10 years from Texas to Montana. And then on the other side of the family, his mom that I said he resembled, the Herrings, they came across the plains, his grandmother Mary Jane Williams, in 1857 across the Rockies in a covered wagon. So even before Lefty went on his quest to be part of the national pastime, the fabric of his ancestors were already part of the American tapestry. And then growing up, he never felt, as I said, that he was poor. And it also was a sense of community. Doors were left unlocked. Everybody shared in what was ever going on. He did not have any money to buy a glove. He first caught town baseball bare-knuckled and bleeding knuckles and was given an old first baseman's glove, and then he went to work at the Union Oil Refinery, and those and the descriptions in the book of how they crawled inside the big oil vats to scrape out the sludge is just something that you just can't even imagine. I remember sitting with Dad, and he pointed over at the pink, you know, oil tanks, and he said, "Vernona, I crawled in those." And, you know, we didn't know what cancer was at in those days, but we knew what $4.65 was. And then, of course, I think what is really amazing is that when his brother took him off to San Francisco Seals, which, of course, was the independent minor league, you know, really almost tripled a caliber at that time in California of the Pacific Coast League, he went to the tryout with a right-hander's glove worn backwards. And when Nick Williams said to him, "You're wearing the wrong glove," and he said, "Yeah, but it doesn't take away from the fun." There were no left-handed gloves to come out at that time. And then as soon as one came out, he had to go back to Union Oil again and make more money. And then, of course, he just, you know, battled his way up through the minors and was fortunate, as he said, to be bought by the Yankees. And I think one of the big telling statements of Lefty's is he said, "You know, I could always keep fame in perspective," because he said, by and large, the boys that I played with were all talented, you know, and they all went out and, you know, played the game with their hearts and soul, and they really wanted to make it. But he said there's something also called luck, so it goes beyond determination. So he said, "I was very lucky also to be, you know, bought by the New York Yankees, and that's why I'm very grateful to God that I was."
Larry Goldstone, tell us a little more about Lefty's pitching style. In those days, a tall will-o'-the-wisp hurler just wasn't very common, and yet he had this incredible supple arm and great fastball.
Well, they've learned a lot more about pitching mechanics since then, obviously, and about a lot of other things, sports medicine. But Lefty generated power through torque. His arm, because it was loose, and Satchel Paige is very much the same, very thin, but they could get a lot of whip and a lot of rotation from, they started with their hips, he had very long legs, he had a high kick, so it started with the hips, went up through the shoulders, in through the elbows, down the wrist, so every joint was involved, and by the time all of that motion resulted in the release of the pitch, there was a lot of power behind it. In those days, they thought what generated power was big muscles. So they loved pitchers who were 225 pounds and 6'2". A lot of times the pitchers were overweight because they thought that weight equated to speed. And the change in that, Lefty today coming up with that frame and that motion nobody would think twice. Mm-hmm. People would understand how he generated such speed. Somebody like Roy Oswalt, who plays now, is very small, mm-hmm. but could throw in the high 90s.
We'll continue our discussion about Lefty Gomez. We're going to take a pledge break and be back with more. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We want to thank everyone who's made their pledge during Topical Currents. We resume our conversation with Vernona Gomez and Lawrence Goldstone. They've collaborated on the book Lefty, An American Odyssey, about the great New York Yankee and World Series record holder Lefty Gomez. Vernona, what was so interesting about Lefty from a baseball fan's view is he bridged the gap. He was great friends with Babe Ruth, and also when the rookie Joe DiMaggio came to New York, they had Lefty be his roommate. What an incredible situation, and both of Ruth and DiMaggio loved him.
Yes, well, he was a great conversationalist, and not only was he a great competitor on and took control of the situation and never berated his, anything that might go on behind him on the field. He could leave the game on the field, and I think that's what Tommy Henrich was saying. Lefty was such a tonic to the team because if they had a devastating defeat, he could make a funny quip and bring the team back together. And, of course, Ruth wanted to be treated like a regular guy. And so he could not go, entertain out at a restaurant because people would be pulling at his clothes. So he entertained at his Riverside apartment and clam cakes that Claire would make. They'd have these witty conversations. And, in fact, I think, as you probably read in the book, on a hot summer night, Babe and Dad would carry the table up to the rooftop to catch a, cool summer breeze because air conditioning didn't exist in apartments then or hotels, only in movie houses. And amongst the laundry strung up on the clotheslines up on the rooftops, they would eat dinner and under the stars, and then Dad would turn his crank up his phonograph, and they'd dance the night away. And of course, my mother, being a dancer on Broadway, working with Gershwin and Richard Rodgers, I mean, she said that Babe was light as a feather on his feet, one of the best dancers she had ever danced with. And then you mentioned that Joe DiMaggio came along, and as my dad was saying, he feels that is what was so great about the Yankees, because as one great player moved off into the horizon, the Yankees, the front office, was smart enough to see the talent coming up, and okay, here is Joe DiMaggio to pull them through the Yankee dynasties of the 30s, and then, of course, the 40s and the 50s. And Joe was had so much confidence, Lefty said. He never met a player that had more confidence, but he was very quiet. But they also shared a common background coming out of the San Francisco Seals. In fact, all those players, Joe Cronin, Tony Lazzari, so many of them, Joe Sewell. Joe Sewell came from Alabama, I'm sorry. But so many of them came out of San Francisco. So it was like a boy of today returning to a college reunion. Hey, remember when we used to do this? And so Joe and he became fast friends, and the friendship lasted a lifetime. And very, very close friends, very, very close friends. They truly loved each other, as my dad has said in print many times.
Larry Goldstone, I was interested to find out in the book, it really kind of struck me that Ruth, that we see in the movies, that he was this wild character who was eating 6 hot dogs between innings and always drunk and all that on the trains. He really wasn't quite that wild a character.
Well, Babe seems to be one of those people who was so extraordinary and had such a large personality and actually was multifaceted, which people did not see, that a lot of people had views of him, all of which were part right, and none of which were all right, all correct. And the Babe that Vernona was talking about in the Riverside Drive apartment, there's one story in the book that when I first heard it, it just touched me, and I had to put it in. They were up on the roof one night, And Babe looked across the Hudson River at Palisades Amusement Park, which was an amusement or Coney Island-like place in New Jersey. And of course, he could never go out because he'd be stormed by the fans. And he looked and he said, "Oh, I wish I could go there." So here is this person who's kind of stuck in his apartment, whose social life was restricted to having friends over, having discussions, dancing on the roof, which all of which is very charming. But the stories about how much he could eat and how much he could drink, there is some truth there too. But as with all of it, every part got overblown. Did Babe play drunk? No, Babe did not play drunk. Did Babe not concern himself with his teammates because he was too busy with high living? Nothing could be farther from the truth. But he was one of these people who was just larger than life in every way, and different people saw different sides of him. I happen to think that Lefty and June and that circle of friends saw a person who was much closer to the truth than what the sports writers saw, and certainly what the people who wrote about him who hardly knew him saw. So it would be nice one day to see a real biography of Babe Ruth that actually had the real guy in it instead of what everybody's fantasy of him was.
Vernona Gomez, daughter of Lefty Gomez, in just a minute or two, could you kind of tell us the story of June O'Day and her sister? They were big time showbiz items, and Lefty saw them, and suddenly he had the full court press on to woo June, but people don't realize just what a big name she was at that time.
Well, my mother and my aunts, Sunnydale, were on the stage since they were 5 and 7. They were Bostonians who were raised in New York, so of course she grew up on the New York pavements, and that was one of the great things about, besides the fact that they were both competitors, I mean, my dad in baseball and my mother on the stage, when Lefty hooked up with June, I mean, you know, she knew New York inside and out, so he was getting an insider's view. And at that time, vaudeville was very, popular, and so she was in Honeymoon Cruise, and she played the Palace when she was 11 years old. And my aunt was a Ziegfeld Follies girl, of course, which was the zenith of glamour. And then June's break came in A Night in Paris with Jake Schubert. And then from there on, she moved to Lawrence Schwab and worked for Richard Rodgers. And then, of course, she was in the Pulitzer Prize-winning play of The I Sing by George Gershwin. So, in fact, her dancing partner was George Murphy, who later became the U.S. Senator from United States Senator from California. And even in the theater, things were, they were not like they were today. They used to go, George used to take her into the men's bathroom so that they would practice their tap dancing routines and hear the clear taps, because it would echo off the tile floors. And then from there, they would go over to George Gershwin's apartment, and he called her Junie Bug. And of course, now you can see that Dad is moving into a new circle of friends. Benny Goodman was in the orchestra. Oscar Levant would play rehearsal piano. And as he said, it was so wonderful. Not only was I in love with June, but I loved all her friends.
It's certainly interesting to hear all of these stories, but we're going to take another short break. We will be back with more. We please ask you to be generous when you make your pledge to WLRN during Topical Currents. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We resume our conversation with Vernona Gomez, daughter of the great Hall of Famer Lefty Gomez, and also author Lawrence Goldstone. They've collaborated on the book Lefty, An American Odyssey. Larry Goldstone, is there a website where people could learn more about the book and get additional information?
Absolutely, leftygomez.com.
Well, that's easy enough. Let's go to Lefty and his years as the Yankees ace. Whenever there was a big game year after year, Lefty was the The Chosen One by Joe McCarthy. His best year was in 1934, but that year they didn't win the pennant. The Tigers were there, and also somebody in St. Louis called Dizzy Dean. Larry, tell us about that.
Dizzy and Lefty, it's very interesting. The most interesting thing about Dizzy and Lefty was the issue with the Hall of Fame. One of the things I noticed when I was doing the book is that the statistics for Dizzy and Lefty were almost identical. Dizzy had a more compact career, 4 years of utter domination. Lefty's career was over 11 years. But in terms of wins, winning percentage, shutouts, they were virtually identical. Lefty's postseason career was better. And both of them were considered really funny. But Dizzy's humor was always about, you know, how smart he was or how smart he wasn't, where Lefty made a lot of self-deprecating cracks about his own pitching ability.
And especially hitting, too.
Absolutely. But when he said the secret of his success is clean living in a fast outfield, and he said until Joe DiMaggio came to the Yankees, nobody knew that he could go back. When Lefty was pitching, nobody knew he could go back on a fly ball. So Lefty made remarks. His funniest, I think, was when Neil Armstrong found some object on the moon, Lefty said, that was a ball Jimmy Fox hit off me in 1937. But when it came time for the Hall of Fame voting, Dizzy got in basically right away because he was kind of homespun and funny, and it took Lefty 20 more years to be elected because the sense of humor, which people loved, actually worked against him. So here you had two dominant pitchers, ferocious competitors, both whose careers were cut short by injuries, with almost identical statistics, and one is viewed very differently than the other just because of the kind of jokes they cracked.
Vernona Gomez, tell me more about those great foreign barnstorming trips, especially Japan. Lefty goes with Ruth and Gehrig and Connie Mack and a host of other stars, and they were just almost gods in Japan.
Yes, in 1934, the All-America players were asked to go to Japan, and of course there had been other American players who had gone to Tokyo to play, but it was because Babe, the Sultan of Swat, was in the lineup that it really became the catalyst catalyst for Japanese baseball to become organized, because when they arrived in Tokyo, 500 million fans were there, and Matsutaro Shiriki, who was the owner of the Yomiuri Shimbun, who said, wow, with this type of enthusiasm, I'm going to organize, you know, a Japanese team from the players who have played against Babe and the Americans. And then, of course, after that trip, after Tokyo, they went and played a game in Shanghai and three in Manila. And then Babe and Claire and his daughter Julia and my mother and father, June and Lefty, and Rose and Bud Hillwerk, who were the founders of Louisville Slugger, decided to go around the world. And that's exactly what they did.
Let's move on post-retirement. We're getting short on time. And talk about Lefty's exploits in Venezuela and also Cuba, and even with Fidel.
Do you want me to start?
What do you want?
Okay, Larry Goldstone.
Okay.
But briefly,
okay.
We don't have much time left.
Okay, in short, Lefty's, after he was done as a player, he went to Caracas to manage a team and was the first American star to manage a team with mixed races, with black players. The Venezuelan League had some extraordinary black American players who could not break the color line. So he, by his statement of doing that, he helped do that. And Pee Wee Reese, who was Jackie Robinson's close friend on the Dodgers, gave Lefty credit for helping to break the color line in baseball. Lefty also managed in Cuba and was so popular, worked a lot with young kids, that when Fidel Castro took over, Lefty was in the country, stuck at Ernest Hemingway's villa, as it turned out, with an invalid passport. And Fidel was very difficult on Americans right from the beginning, but through his personal intervention, Lefty got to leave the country. So here you had this arch-communist who despised America, but Lefty was different. And throughout his life, people just dealt with him as someone who was different and always in a good way.
No one ever seemed to have a bad word to say about Lefty, and most baseball fans even probably wouldn't recognize the name of Edward Ford, but Lefty gave him his nickname. Tell us.
Well, Lefty was his skipper when he was in Edenton, South Carolina, or is it North Carolina? And, you know, and he called him Whitey, and then there's that marvelous story where they were supposed to be in at a 10 o'clock curfew, and Whitey went to a amusement park with his friend, and they got on the Ferris wheel, and now it's now 5 minutes to 10, now it's 4 minutes to 10, and they're calling out to the barker, please, let us off. You know, we've got, please, they're screaming, let us off. No, he stops the Ferris wheel, and they're stuck at the top, and they finally, at 5 minutes past 10, they run back to the hotel, the team hotel, and my dad's sitting there, and they tried to explain the story that they were stuck at the Ferris wheel. Dad's waiting for his two pigeons, and of course he said, no, that story, I cannot, you know, that can't be true. And so he fined them $5 each, and then about 10 years later, Whitey is pitching for the Yankees, and Joe DiMaggio has a pregame and postgame show, and there's Dad on the TV telling about how he had set these two players up by paying the fellow who was running the Ferris wheel, you know, $5 or $10. And so he stormed up and said, I can't believe you did that. Give me back my $10. So Dad paid him the $10, and Whitey said, great, you only charged me $5, so at least I made $5 on the deal.
Of course, Lefty's nickname was often called El Gufo, but he was anything but. He was very introspective, and most importantly, he really hated to lose. I have about a minute left. Lawrence Goldstone, put him in context as far as all-time major league players.
Well, in terms of his ability, he was the equal of just about any pitcher who played. Had he not been hurt, and he was only hurt because in that era they pitched it till their arms fell off. If he had not been hurt and been around 18 or 20 years, he would have had a lot more victories, and his statistics would be up there with anyone's. But the thing that I like most about Lefty is if he had gone into writing, my business, I believe he would have been one of the great chroniclers of American sports. And when I said he reminds me of Ring Lardner, it was very Mark Twain-esque because I got to see the original interviews and his voice and his insight and his understanding of the nature of America and the nature of baseball was extraordinary, and that's the thing that stayed with me the most.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the book called Lefty, an American Odyssey, and once again, the website is leftygomez.com.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
And we've been speaking with the daughter of the great Hall of Famer, Lefty Gomez, Vernona Gomez, and also co-author Lawrence Goldstone. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you about Lefty Gomez and baseball. And thanks for listening this hour, and thanks for pledging. Your support of regional and local programs is greatly appreciated. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Peter Jay and Michael Stock. Paul Leary gives production support. Again, that pledge line number, 866-247-9576. And tomorrow we present a special food and dining program with Linda Gassenheimer. We'll get a report from her visit to the huge Fancy Food Festival in New York City. 180,000 products. And the calendar on this day in 1962, 50 years ago, the birth of Motley Crue drummer Tommy Lee in Athens, Greece. Girls, 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 Heather Locklear, and of course, Pam Anderson. Also on this day in 1995, 17 years ago,
A jury finds O.J. Simpson not guilty of killing ex-wife Nicole Brown and waiter Ronald Goulburn. And one more while we remember Montecor, the White Tiger. On this day in 2003, 9 years ago, Roy Horn of Siegfried and Roy was in critical condition on his 59th birthday following a tiger attack during a performance. The incident ended the most popular show in Las Vegas. And we leave with a thought from Roy Horn, who worked with Siegfried for 5 decades. Quote, "They were not ready for me. They were not ready for me to do the big show upstairs. Not yet." This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.